It's a new year, but the same old is once again being served to us. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Good to be with you, Barry. Happy New Year. And this, by the time this plays, it'll be a week late. But Happy New Year to you and to the listeners out there.
Well, Happy New Year. And Chuck, it's okay because, you know, usually right after the new year is when everybody is busy trying to, well, keep their resolutions that they've promised themselves going into the upcoming year. And so I'm glad we're kind of doing this a week later, because it's usually by this time of the year, a week later, that you come to the realization that many of your resolutions are not actually attainable. Whether that be from lack of motivation, whether that be from lack of resources, whether that be from lack of opportunity or access, or whether it be just from overreaching, I guess, Chuck, is a good way to put it, shooting higher than you can possibly climb and then looking up at the climb and realizing that it's too daunting to even start, and so you turn away from it. Now, for those who make these resolutions at the beginning of a new year and stick to them, well, kudos to you. I've never been one to make resolutions, Chuck, because invariably if I do that, if I go down the silly road, at least to me silly, of opening my mouth and vowing a vow that I just really can't keep, the Lord really has a way of helping me to understand that I can't do this on my own strength, and I usually end up failing and falling flat on my face. You've never had this situation now, have you?
Oh, please. Let me tell you, I stopped making resolutions simply because what it does is it basically, if you have any kind of lingering thoughts about your own personal failures, all it does is reinforce those. Because the fact is that you want to set an example for yourself. You want to set a goal for yourself. You can't reach, for the most part.
Right.
If your goal is to drink more beer and watch more television, okay, that's pretty easily achievable.
yeah, probably is.
If your goal is to work harder and get more things done and be more efficient, some of those are achievable, but they take an awful lot of work. You really do have to set something realistic, and that requires time, something which I don't have. My wife and I are in the middle of moving. We've bought a house, and we're in the middle of trying to get the guy who lives in the house to finish it up so we can get in it, and we're trying to finish our own house so we can get out of it. So there's lots of work being done all around. That's kind of why we haven't recorded, because both you and I have been so busy. We've had to run some reruns.
Well, and that's true. And yes, it's also around the holidays, and I think all of our listeners can understand and empathize with us in the fact that, you know, usually the holidays get a lot busier than any of us ever really want them to get, because we end up, whether it's office parties or family gatherings or last minute shopping or taking things back that just didn't fit or wasn't the right color
or whatever,
you had three of. Oftentimes, that period there between Thanksgiving, Black Friday, and the first week after the new year, usually gets a little busy. It basically, the entire month of December, Chuck, I think, is almost a mulligan when you've got a family and you're really trying to keep things going, keep your business moving, and make sure everybody's happy, visit relatives, do all that fun stuff. So we're now getting back in the swing of things with the new year. And honestly, Charles, we really didn't miss a beat because, like I said, new year's, new resolutions, except it's really the same old that's being handed to us. And as we look across the landscape of our state and our nation, really, not much has really changed. We still have, although we've got a new person in the seat of the Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, Paul Ryan from Wisconsin. Honestly, there's really not a much difference in what he's been doing since he took that office at the end of October to what former Speaker of the House, John Boehner from Ohio, was doing in the 3 years he held it before then. And that is basically making noises and motions to make it look like they're really getting something done, when in reality, the things that they are doing are just actually helping the advance the agenda of their ideological, supposedly ideological opponents in the White House, the Obama administration. And again, nothing has really changed now, has it?
Oh, absolutely. Barry. We've gone from essentially misleadership A to misleadership B. The Republicans basically proved that they really didn't have the guts to really seriously change things up, because they had a couple of candidates for speaker who really would have been involved in changing things up in the House. And they walked away from it. In fact, we can't sell this to our constituents, blah, 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 blah. There were several guys that would have been great candidates for speaker who basically got left by the wayside and were supposed to pull out so that Ryan would have no opposition, and refused to do so, much to their credit. I can't think of who off the top of my head, the names off the top of my head, but I remember at the time thinking, yeah, he would be a much better speaker. So we're going to get what we paid for with Paul Ryan. And unfortunately, what we paid for was a guy who was sold as a conservative, but who isn't. He's a moderate. He's an establishment guy in the same vein as Rubio, who's running for president, was sold as a Tea Party conservative and is in fact an establishment moderate. And there was an article I saw today I kind of laughed at. I recognized the rhetoric. And what it says is basically was that, well, Rubio is establishment, then that term has been redefined, was the gist of it. And I'm like, oh, well, that's exactly what we say when we say that, for instance, if Jeb Bush is a conservative, then that term has no meaning. And that's exactly the kind of language this article a title had. And it was in National Review, of all places. Big, big shock. National Review is a huge GOP establishment publication. And they're essentially trying to shame us into accepting Rubio as some kind of a flaming conservative, when he isn't. And we're getting the same thing with Paul Ryan. Well, you know, he was the conservative that kept Romney honest. And I had to laugh. I said, if anything, Romney corrupted Ryan. Ryan didn't correct Romney. That's what we're dealing with, Barry. We're dealing with the rhetoric. You know, for years, Republicans were so downtrodden in the House and the Senate. And, you know, every once in a while we get a president elected, but Democrats had controlled Congress for 40 years, and then all of a sudden Reagan came, and we got we switched hands. We switched hands back and forth between the House and the Senate and the two different parties. And one thing that everyone should notice is when those two houses switch hands, nothing different happens. If you recall, we were all going to be jumping for joy when John Boehner, some of us weren't jumping for joy, but we were all supposed to get down on the Lord and on our hands and knees and thank God that John Boehner was the new speaker, because all this and this and this and this was going to happen. Well, what happened? We got Nancy Pelosi light.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, actually, I'm not even sure light, because he was probably darker than her with all the tanning he does.
he was at least more orange.
He was more orange than Nancy was.
Yeah, Johnny Walker, orange.
It reminds me of that old song where the verse goes, second verse, same as the first.
That's right.
You just keep repeating it over and over. And that seems to be what we've got. Now, you know, again, you and I have talked about this before, and I think I even talked about it on the program, that either the members of the House Freedom Caucus, who are supposedly the conservative / Tea Party members of the House Republican Caucus, are either sly as a fox or dumb as a stump, because they're supporting or kind of giving a nod to Paul Ryan to be the speaker, taking Boehner's place for the remainder of the term, was either a very shrewd move to allow Paul Ryan, who could have been a very significant threat in the 2017-2018 nomination for speaker, because remember, Ryan only holds this spot through the end of this session of Congress.
Right.
In the fact that he's just filling in for John Boehner's term at this point. And there has to be another election, usually, and it's probably going to be in December this year, after the election and after the new members of Congress are brought in and appointed and sworn in, for Ryan to then stand for re-election to the office of Speaker. Now, perhaps the Freedom Caucus was wise in thinking, well, you know, Boehner has created so much turmoil, and there is so much that that is not able to be really accomplished because you've got a term-limited president who is a partisan, progressive, liberal, committed to his ideology, and that nothing they really would do would get done. So why put your guy, which was Daniel Webster from Florida,
that
to be a short-termer when you can put probably the person who might be the most dangerous opponent in an election of that sort, Paul Ryan, who the establishment loves and who the less clear-thinking conservatives seem to think is one of them, that you elevate him to the speakership to basically continue the sinking of the SS Boehner. And then when he, as captain, goes down with his ship, then in December you vote in your Daniel Webster, or even perhaps your Jim Jordans, to be the new speaker coming into a new Congress with a new president. They could be that wise, or else they didn't think about any of that, and they got wowed by the Paul Ryan mystique, and they decided they wanted to get behind him, and so they thought he would be better than Boehner because they believed the rhetoric as well, and they didn't look behind the curtain to see that Paul Ryan really is not a movement conservative. He's an establishment conservative. In other words, he sounds conservative until it comes to expanding government, and then he's right there with the establishment.
Well, you're now getting into the thing where you and I have basically almost stopped using that term conservative.
Oh, absolutely.
It doesn't mean anything. All a conservative does, and I'm trying to remember who said this. All a conservative does is essentially protect the things that have been done up to a certain point.
That was Robert Louis Dabney.
Yes, R.L. Dabney.
Talking about the conservatism just accedes to the innovation of the progressives after a time. You know, the liberal progressives will move forward with this grand thing to centralize power or to expand their reach, and the conservatives will mouth, opposition to it. But after a little while, then they'll move to that position too, and then the liberals will move ahead a little bit farther in radicalism. And the conservatives will decry that a little while longer until the liberals get their way. And then after a period of time passes, the conservatives will move to that point too as the new status quo.
Yeah, exactly. That's been the problem all along. It's Leninism.
Yes.
Two steps forward, one step back.
Right, exactly. Meaning you're always advancing. It just doesn't look like you're advancing that fast,
that's right.
But you're always advancing.
It looks like you're actually retreating when in fact you've advanced one step. Yes, we went too far, but and here's where the new line is. Constantly, over and over and over. People want to talk about Alinsky. Well, all Alinsky did was take Lenin and Stalin and sort of condense them into easily rememberable rules. Because if you've ever read Lenin, oh my gosh, ponderous, just garbage. If you really want to, you can find English translations of a lot of his stuff. And it's sort of like trying to read Karl Marx. If you've ever actually read Karl Marx, which I'm pretty sure you have.
I had to read it in college, yes.
Yeah, there's a lot of rhetoric, there's a lot of jargon, and you have to cut through that. There's a lot of the language of revolution in there. You know, he wants to talk about, 18 Brumaire. Well, if you don't know what 18 Brumaire is, it's basically the French redesigned the calendar after the French Revolution to start with the year one, and renamed all the months, and did all these strange things. Went to a 10-day week. They redesigned the week to go to 10 days, and it was all disastrous because nobody could communicate with them. They'd always put out official documents in this language, and everybody would go, "What are you talking about? We don't know. We don't know what these days are. We don't know what these any of this is." So what did they have to do? Well, they had to go back to the standard calendar, and plus they created a nightmare because, God designed people to be on a 7-day week, and what they discovered was that people were getting sick and dying because they weren't on any kind of a normal schedule. So anybody who believes that, you know, we really don't need the seventh day isn't paying attention.
Yeah.
But that's the whole point. The whole point is that this is how we get people who purport to be conservative defending Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, all that. Well, we've had these for nearly a century. Yeah, we have, but they weren't right a century ago. And some of them we've had for 50 years, and they weren't right 50 years ago. In fact, one of the problems we have with healthcare today is because of the things that were done in the mid-1960s with healthcare through Medicare and Medicaid.
Right.
Which has grossly ballooned the prices of things, and essentially made doctors more and more and more employees of the state or pawns of the insurance company. Six and one, half dozen of another.
Yeah, that's true.
And this is why we have the problem we have now. And now, of course, even the thing that was supposedly going to fix it all is turning out to be a boondoggle and nightmare. People that were supposed to be forced onto healthcare plans, of quote-unquote affordable healthcare plans that now exceed the cost of what I used to pay as a single personal buyer of health insurance, because of the fact that everybody on the planet, everybody in the United States, is now covered for things that were never covered before.
They had
to rely on. I've tried to explain to people over and over and over again that you can't cover everything and have the cost go down.
No.
But
absolutely not.
Now we have this system. People are actually paying the fine rather than buying the health insurance because it's cheaper.
Funny that, isn't it?
Yeah. So this is what happens. There's always a law of unintended consequences. And conservatives, when I call a true conservative, someone who looks at it through a constitutional lens. And the Constitution is merely a document which sets the guidelines under which government must operate and sets its limits and boundaries. Guess what? One of those limits and boundaries was healthcare. In other words, that was not permitted to the federal government.
Right.
And in most state constitutions, healthcare is not permitted to the state government if the constitutions of the state are written properly. And exactly. Unfortunately, most of them aren't anymore. A lot of them have been just modified they're so grandiose and so long. You know, the United States Constitution, if you laid it out in 12-point type, is what, about 4 or 5 pages long?
Right.
What the Ohio Constitution laid out in 12-point type is what, like 48 pages long, something like that?
Yeah, I've got it sitting here on my bookshelf. It is an actual more than a little booklet. Yes.
Yeah, it's that's because we, by 1851, we had gone over to positive law.
Yeah.
And the difference between positive and negative law. Well, we're really going far afield from what we were going to talk about. But,
no, we're not. We're right there. I mean, because we're going to roll this right back around. We have some things that we need to build out first. So go ahead and talk about the difference between positive and negative law, because that's very important.
Yeah. Right. A negative law sounds bad, but it's the best kind of law, because what it says is to the person who's being governed, it says you're allowed to do everything except what's forbidden by this particular thing. And it says to the government, you're not allowed to do anything except the powers that are given to you directly in this document. That's negative law. In other words, negative law is simply says everything to you except what's forbidden. And we will specifically lay out what is forbidden. Positive law says, well, you can do everything that we tell you in the law. In other words, a law has to be made for everything. And we can see that in modern legislature. Oh, we need a law for this. We need a law for that. We need a law for another thing. Oh, we better have a law. We better have a law. We better have a law. Well, there's legitimate laws being passed to cover things that nobody thought about before that are within the bounds of the Constitution. Then there's a lot of stuff that isn't within the bounds of the Constitution. And that brings us back to the whole idea that repealing health care. Basically, the courts should instantly have looked at it and said, no, it's well beyond the bounds of the Constitution. But John Roberts couldn't be convinced of that. and hence we get a thing. He gets two bites at the apple and gets it and bites wrong both times.
Right, exactly. Well, Chuck, you know, and that's the thing here with as we're talking about Paul Ryan, you know, and we've got a clip here we're going to listen to in just a minute, but we're recording this on Wednesday, and today is the day that the House of Representatives is going to take up the reconciliation document, which is a procedural move in order to, and it's one that they're using as Ryan says, we finally found the smart strategy, unquote, to get a bill on Obama's desk. Well, the smart strategy is clean bills. Just send clean bills up. But no, what this reconciliation is a group of fixes and changes and, you know, tweaks. And what they're going to do with this bill is to put in a what they call a repeal and replace provision in Obamacare. Which right there, Chuck, is your first signal
that
the House leadership under Paul Ryan is no different than the leadership under John Boehner. And then secondly, well, we're going to defund Planned Parenthood in this. Well, those are all wonderful things, Charles. And honestly, they're things that, well, at least the defunding of Planned Parenthood need to be done almost immediately, if not sooner. But neither thing is really going to get done. And let's just be quite frank, even after, like I said, we're recording this on Wednesday, the vote is going to happen this afternoon. At 1:30, they're going to start debate on the floor, an hour's worth of debate on the floor, then there's going to be a couple procedural things, and then at about 4:30 this afternoon, the vote is going to be scheduled, and of course there'll be speeches around the vote too. So by evening, you know, by evening news tonight, we'll know, or on Wednesday night, we'll know if this bill passed with its basic majority that it needs in order to be sent on to the president. Now, the reconciliation has already passed in the Senate, and so they use that in the Senate in order to get this bill out so that the House could vote on it, and then it will be sent to President Obama's desk for his, and let's just be honest, Chuck, unless he really like changes a leaf, it'll be his veto, not his signature. That means we are going to be looking at a necessary two-thirds vote in each chamber of Congress, both in the House and in the Senate, in order to override the veto of President Obama on this reconciliation bill. Now, again, given the fact that they all, you know, once they pass it, they'll engross it, et cetera, it'll probably go to Obama's desk sometime later this week or maybe the first of next week. He has 10 days, by the Constitution, he has 10 days in which to decide what he wants to do except Sunday. So, you know, he's got actually 11 days because Sundays are accepted. And he could immediately, you know, make a big show of it and sign it off and do this thing. And he might just do that. Or he might wait until after the 12th of January, which is the date scheduled for the State of the Union address that he'll be giving in front of that same Congress next week. And so we'll find out over the weekend if he's going to go ahead and just immediately veto it and kind of try to force their hand on a veto override before the State of the Union address, or if he will wait until afterwards. Either way, he's going to veto the bill, and either way, and I hate breaking this news to people if you haven't already figured this out, there is no way of getting two-thirds votes in both chambers of the Congress in order to override the president's veto.
There's a 0% chance, right?
There is 0% chance because of the Senate. The Senate will not, cannot bring up 67 votes, Chuck. There's just no way. They ended up having to do this measure with reconciliation, the quote-unquote smart strategy that Paul Ryan talks about, because they couldn't get past the filibuster numbers in the Senate of 60. If you can't get 60 votes in the Senate in order to end a filibuster or invoke cloture, as it's called, in order to bring a bill up for a vote that needs just a simple majority to pass, which would have been with any other provision like the budget extension that they did in December, you certainly are not going to magically find that many plus an extra seven in the Senate who all of a sudden will say, well, you know, you're right all along. And yeah, Planned Parenthood needs to be defunded. And yeah, Obamacare is not working. And we need to fix it the way the Republicans want to fix that. It isn't going to happen.
Well, they need they need 290 in the House as well.
They need 290 in the House. And unless you hand Nancy Pelosi the farm, which basically means strip out everything in another bill that you just put into the reconciliation, which is a strategy, Chuck, that I'm not totally blind to, that they could come back and take away everything that they pass in this bill if they work out that kind of an arrangement.
Yep.
But really, they're not going to work out that kind of arrangement because this is the best of both possible worlds for both caucuses, because the Republicans now get to go out and print up their campaign material saying how they've fixed Obamacare and defunded Planned Parenthood, and the Democrats can go out with their campaign materials talking about how they protected Planned Parenthood and protected people's health care by not allowing the president's veto to be overridden. They both can pander to their base with the same vote.
Exactly.
So there's nothing that's going to change, Chuck. It's just ridiculous to think that this actually is going to solve the problem, and that some 10 days from the time that it goes to the president's desk, he's either going to sign it or let it go into law without a signature, or they're going to override a veto. Now, Ryan talks about, we've got a clip, and this was in Breitbart.com. And I thought the headline was hilarious, Chuck, because it's a pull quote directly from Ryan's interview written by Jeff Poor of Breitbart.com, where on the headline says, Paul Ryan, quote, "We have to use every tool at our disposal to keep this executive branch honest," unquote. Well, Chuck, if this is what they're using to keep the executive branch honest, they're failing in their primary job, because this does nothing but give cover to both caucuses in both chambers and the president, who honestly doesn't care anyway. He's a lame duck. This is his last year in office, barring some unique circumstance. Let's put it this way.
Very unique.
But the point is, he is going to go ahead and veto this bill. And they do not have the votes, nor will they ever find the votes to override the veto. And so basically, this is all a storefront window display that honestly isn't for sale. You really will not be able to buy this. You will not be able to get a repeal or replace of Obamacare or a repeal of Obamacare. You will not be able to get Planned Parenthood being completely defunded. It just isn't going to happen in this bill. And I am aghast, Charles, at the number of conservatives who are buying this. Just ridiculous. As I mentioned to you, I was involved in something just the other day talking about this very issue, where some conservatives were saying, well, you know, when we had that vote on the budget, which honestly would have been the best place to do this, Chuck, if you wanted to defund Planned Parenthood, is zero fund them in the budget. If you want to repeal Obamacare, it's to zero fund Obamacare and complete the collapse of this behemoth. But in that bill, they didn't want to do it because they didn't think they could come up with enough votes in the Senate for cloture. They couldn't get to 60, much less 67. But if you want to do it, that's the way you do it. This is not the way it gets done. Although Ryan's like, well, we've been at this for what, 5 years now? What is he actually thinking? And we'll be at it for another 5 years if I can keep it up.
Yeah.
And all they were worried about is, let's get the bill on Obama's desk. Well, that's great. And everybody can go out and campaign against Barack Obama, who's not running for re-election.
Yeah, exactly.
that's a wonderful strategy for Republicans who want to avoid the obvious, which is the fact that it's either Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, most likely, who will be running for election. And you really want to get Bernie Sanders as a sitting senator, you want to get his vote online. You don't care about Barack Obama. But really, and he even admits that they anticipate that the president will veto it. And he basically says, you know, we'll have a veto override vote on this later in the month. Chuck, I wonder if that is, they're going to have a veto override on it later in the month after all of their people who are running for election and re-election have gotten all their campaign materials printed saying how they voted to kill or to replace Obamacare and defund Planned Parenthood.
Oh, absolutely, Barry. I mean, this is so obvious to anyone who knows anything about how these guys campaign. Well, I voted for that. Okay, how did you vote previously for this and this and this and this that basically gave Obama the power? Well, let's not talk about that. That was then. This is now. That's what you'll get. And all the establishment types, and if you hang around conservative discussion sites, what you'll see is establishment types come in and say, well, he did this and he did this and he did this and she did that. Well, yes, when it didn't count, when it didn't mean anything. And in this in this vote, it doesn't mean anything. And what I said, let's look at the votes where it did mean something. And guess what? They broke ranks and voted with the Democrats on this, stating that they had to do so as a matter of conscience. Well, guess what? That scores way more points on the other side than this meaningless vote will.
Right.
And you have to be cognizant of that. That, ladies and gentlemen, please pay attention to your representative's voting record. My representative has a dismal voting record. He votes with the establishment every time. He voted with John Boehner every time. He's in line to become, I think, Ways and Means Chairman?
Yes.
I have Pat Tiberi, and many of you out there will as well. And unfortunately, when I move to my new house, I'll still have Pat Tiberi. Maybe I can do something to help bring him around or to vote for somebody who will have the guts to run against him. Unfortunately, he has, like many of these guys do, he has grabbed the Republican Party machine within his congressional district. So, but that's what happens. And then they hide behind these meaningless votes that guys like Ryan set up, and Boehner used to set them up as well, so that they can get so-called conservative cover. So that's what's happening. All right, you want to play this thing?
Yeah, let's go ahead and play this because there are some other things that Paul Ryan says in here that I want to unpack, especially this whole idea from the pull quote about using the tools at their disposal to address this problem.
Okay, the interviewer is Sean Hannity. This is from the Sean Hannity program on Fox News.
And welcome back to Hannity. Now, tomorrow, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives is set to vote on a bill that would repeal Obamacare. Now, just how significant a vote is this? Joining us now in a Hannity exclusive, the brand-new Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, is with us, Congressman from Wisconsin. Welcome back, sir.
Happy New Year, Sean. How you doing?
Happy New Year to you. Okay, tell us about this vote. There has been a lot of angst about not being able to repeal and replace Obamacare.
Right.
And a lot of people have wanted.
I'm stopping this for a second. Repeal and replace. I've been arguing with people for years now about this repeal and replace strategy. Okay, why are we replacing? Here's what we should be replacing it with. Nothing. Oh no, we have to do something. This is the conservative mantra now. This is what we were talking about: two steps forward, one back. Mm-hmm. We have to do something. Well, the something that we should be doing is repealing Obamacare and repealing Medicare. I know that's going to hit a lot of people hard, but the fact is that is what basically really messed up everything. Okay, back to it.
Including myself, the power of the purse to be used to stop it. Tell us what this is going to do.
Yeah, so we've been at this, what, for 5 years now? We finally found what I think is the smart strategy to be able to get a bill on his desk. We've never been able to get around a filibuster in the Senate to get a bill to repeal Obamacare. But by the way, this also defunds Planned Parenthood, which is a very high priority of ours. We could never get through the Senate filibuster. So we used the one rule, the one tool we have a year. We call this reconciliation, so we can get around the Senate filibuster to get a bill on his desk defunding Obamacare and Planned Parenthood. We're passing that tomorrow. I fully anticipate the president will veto this. But, I mean, how many times have we been saying we want to put bills on his desk that say who we are, what we believe versus what he believes, and that he will veto? Then we'll have a veto override vote on that later in the month. But this is the first time we've been able to get on his desk a bill going after Obamacare and Planned Parenthood.
Let me give you a chance, because you're new in this position, and I actually know that you were fairly reluctant. I don't think this is a job that you really wanted, but you did take it. And I don't blame you for not wanting it. It's not exactly the most loved position in Washington. But let me give you an outline of where I think conservatives are frustrated. And I asked you about this the last time. but it's Obamacare, it's executive action on immigration, now on gun control. You mentioned Planned Parenthood, which I'm glad you brought into this. The Iranian deal, the Syrian refugees, controlling the borders. Tell us, expand on your vision. Where are you going to take things? What's going to be different?
Hey, tell me about it. I've been a frustrated conservative as well. So, number one, okay, I'm hitting the...
Stop the tape. Yes, I understand.
Here we go. We now have a new adjective to add in front of the word conservative. He's now a frustrated conservative. What does that mean, Chuck? It means that he's frustrated that all of these conservatives can't just vote the way he wants them to, i.e. an establishment-type vote, and call it conservatism. That's what he's frustrated about.
Right. And basically,
I think this is just absolutely hilarious. You know, it's wonderful to hear Sean Hannity doing what Sean Hannity does so well, which is be a mouthpiece for the Republican Party talking points. And what we have here is Paul Ryan, who it struck me as he was talking, Chuck. You know, I read this and it didn't hit me, but when he was saying it, it hit me. It took 5 years to figure out this strategy to come to reconciliation. Or now, what happened during those years when John Boehner was Speaker and Paul Ryan was a chief lieutenant of his?
Yeah, Ways and Means
chairman.
Yeah,
a vice presidential candidate in 2012. Are you telling me that with their brain trust and with their advisors, nobody came up with the idea of reconciliation until just right now? It doesn't make any sense because a reconciliation bill happens regularly, Chuck, every year.
Every year.
Every year reconciliation happens when you're trying to adjust spending versus your revenues coming in, and you're trying to harmonize things, and you may have half a dozen different bills out there that all touch on the same issue, and you want to make sure you clean everything up so you don't end up with a complete train wreck. You still have a train wreck because it's the federal government, but it's not a complete train wreck.
Just a small train wreck.
Okay, so anyhow, I just wanted to bring that out for folks to start. Sometimes you have to ask the question, why? Or why not? Why didn't they pick on this strategy over the last 5 years? This isn't the first time in history a reconciliation bill has been brought before the Congress. But this is the first time in this cycle that you have a open seat for president that your party's running for, and that you're trying to create some ability for certain candidates. And although, yeah, the one that you probably don't want is going to benefit from this too, i.e. Ted Cruz.
Right.
But, you know, for Marco Rubio and others, that you know, they can use this in their presidential campaigns.
Oh, sure. And they all will.
And Ryan hat tips on this a little bit later. So let's go back to what he said.
Well, one thing I will say, let's do a little political genealogy just for a second. Paul Ryan ran as running mate to Mitt Romney in 2012. Part of the everybody thought that we need to get Romney so we can get rid of Obamacare. Remember that?
Exactly.
Who's the grandpappy of Obamacare?
Mitt Romney with Romney Care in Massachusetts.
Exactly. So repeal and replace thing, okay, it's just utter nonsense, and Ryan knows that. Okay.
Well, and the other reason, Chuck, is the reason why repeal and replace and not just repeal is because if we repeal, we will lose the presidency, but if we repeal and replace, we can start bringing people back into the fold to vote Republican.
Yeah.
Really, everything about a vote in Congress is only about two things, Chuck: money and votes. And not the votes on the floor, the votes back home.
Yeah.
And not the money that is being appropriated in the bill, but the money that's coming from the special interests.
This is why everything gets done in the first year of a congressional term, and the second year of the congressional term, nothing gets done. Because if you do too much, you're out. And if you do too little, you're out. So you make it look like you're doing something when you do nothing, especially in an election year and especially in a presidential election year. Okay.
Reset button. We're going to do things differently around here in the House. Number two, I'm decentralizing power so every conservative, every member of Congress has a greater ability to participate in the process so that we can really have this place work the way the founders intended it to work. But number three, we have to use every tool at our disposal to keep this executive branch honest, to keep oversight over them. So let's take the executive amnesty. We went the court route and we've been successful. We're going after the president in court on Obamacare issues as well. We're succeeding in court there. We've used the power of the purse with riders on a whole host of things, pro-life riders, Internal Revenue Service riders, EPA riders. And at the end of the day, Sean, what really matters, though, is winning an election. We have to have a conservative in the White House. We have
Stop
to have
it right there.
In the White House that isn't trashing the country.
Okay, Chuck, again, like I said, Ryan hat tip. The only thing that matters is winning elections.
Bingo.
Okay? Bingo. Right on it. Now, it's interesting because if you'll know these, what I call adjectival conservatives, all want a hat tip to the founders. And he said it here. He said this whole idea, we want this place working the way the founders intended it to work. And that's a quote from Paul Ryan. And then he says, but we have to use every tool at our disposal. Okay, Chuck, if you put those two things together, that means they actually have to go back to the document that is the organizational, operational document for our government, which is the Constitution of the United States. And it's funny because you and I kind of, you know, we've looked at this document a couple of times.
More than a couple, I think, yeah.
More than a couple, maybe. And it occurred to me, Charles, that, you know, if he wants to look at tools at his disposal, he should start with Article 1, Section 1 of the United States Constitution, which says that all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States. Right there, anytime the executive, Obama, executive branch, tries to implement a law, I'll say with expanded background checks for guns or requiring people to become federally licensed firearm dealers if grandpa gives his grandson his old Henry 22, Chuck, that's creating a new law.
Yep, it sure is.
That isn't a phone and a pen kind of thing that the executive branch has the power to do. It just doesn't happen that way. It's not supposed to happen that way. But the only way it does happen that way is with a Congress who either doesn't understand their constitutional duties or doesn't care. And so we got that. And then we also have to look in Article 2, because in Article 2, you know, which is the executive article, it talks about how the president has to do certain things. And the first thing a president has to do upon being elected, before he enter on the execution of his office, the Constitution in Article 2 says, he shall take the following oath or affirmation, quote, I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, unquote. Folks, that's what the president has to swear to. If he decides by executive order with a pen and a phone to start creating laws, he is no longer preserving, protecting, and defending the Constitution. He is trying to obliterate it. And that means that the Congress now has a role to play. Now, don't they, Chuck?
Oh, absolutely. Because
what is that role, Chuck?
Well, okay. There is another tool that Speaker Ryan seems to have forgotten about. And it's because it scares everybody to death, as it was designed to do. It's supposed to be a scary specter. And that is the tool that everybody refuses to use of impeachment.
Right. Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution.
Exactly. And also, I believe it's in Article 1 as well, that the where it outlines that the power of impeachment lies in the House.
Right, exactly.
Indictment. The indictment is in the House, and the trial is in the Senate. And in the case of a president, the presiding officer is the Chief Justice of the United States. However, in the case of any other officer, it is simply the the president of the Senate. It's either the president or the president pro tem, and I can't remember which, because there is a difference. And you and I discussed that on this program. We figured out who the president pro tem was. And currently, right now, I think the president pro tem is Harry Reid, isn't he?
Harry Reid, exactly.
Yeah. And the president, of course, is Joe Biden. president of the Senate. So what a lot of people say is, well, we've tried to impeach the president before and it was unsuccessful. And I would say au contraire, because even if the president is not removed, not convicted and removed, he has certainly served notice that they're not afraid to use the tool, as we discovered with Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton, when he was impeached, and he was not impeached for a sexual sin. I'm sorry, that was not what he was impeached for. He was impeached for committing perjury, which is a high crime. As the crimes laid out in Article 2, high crimes and misdemeanors, that is a high crime. Perjury in a law case. And, of course, if you remember, Bill Clinton tried to play the executive privilege. You know, you can't depose me in this case because I'm president of the United States. I have executive privilege. And they're like, we're not going to be deposing you on any national secrets. We're deposing you on your perjury in a civil case. The president is not above the law. Even though many people, including Republicans and including people who want to call themselves conservative, seem to think that the president is some sort of elective king, and we elect a new king. Well, a king, very often, in his hands rests all three branch authorities, judicial, legislative, executive. And our president doesn't have that. As we've just outlined, there is a separation of powers. And the separation of powers are legislatures pass laws, presidents enforce them, and they don't make them. And they don't say, well, look, this law is vague, and therefore I'm going to write a rule to allow me to enforce what I see the law as. Now,
exactly.
I've had people say to me that they wanted to see the power of executive order eliminated. And I'm like, okay, you can't do that either.
No, you cannot.
Because that's how a president makes certain that the people in his cabinet, the officers whom he has under him to run these departments, because let's face it, the president cannot run all the departments. That's why we have secretaries. They're in charge of these departments.
Indeed.
And his job is to write executive orders to these heads of these departments to force them to do their constitutional duty. Not to confiscate weapons. So that's where we are with this, Barry. It's a gross misunderstanding. Paul Ryan has showed he really doesn't understand the Constitution very well. And that's not surprising because I think he's an attorney. And attorneys are terribly miseducated. Unless they go to a handful of law schools, they're terribly miseducated on the Constitution. Because the idea is that the Constitution is whatever the high court says it is. Well, no, that's incorrect. There is plain language. Are there nebulous places where the court has to step in and say, well, this is what this actually means? Of course there are. This is a document written by men. This isn't the Bible, and it's enforced by men, and therefore mistakes are going to get made, and misunderstandings are going to come up.
But exactly.
Some of these things are clearly artificially induced misunderstandings.
Of course. Well, and here's the other thing we have to keep in mind, too, Chuck, and again, we try to encourage folks who take our classes at Institute on the Constitution or who listen to this program to think carefully, deeply, biblically, and constitutionally about these things that are being said by politicians. And one of the key things that Paul Ryan said here shows that, again, I believe that they're ignorant of or just apathetic toward constitutional governance. Because as being a quote-unquote frustrated conservative, he's basically saying, well, we've got to do all this stuff to make it the way the founders intended it to work. And so he says, well, that's executive amnesty. We went the court route, and we've been successful. Well, Chuck, who has the responsibility over immigration and naturalization in the United States under our Constitution?
Article 1 says it's Congress.
It is Congress. And so, therefore, was Congress going to the courts over this issue the actual real way, with the tool that the Constitution gives them to do this? Or was it passing a law or basically passing an amendment that said that the president's actions have no force at all, are null and void?
Which, of course, they are. That is, you know, one of the things that came out of Marbury versus Madison, as bad a decision as that was, and everybody talks about that being a landmark. the last line of it is basically that a law is repugnant to the Constitution or no law at all.
Exactly. Now, again, I'm not necessarily going to beat up Paul Ryan for the fact that Congress went to court over this because, you know, if they realize that, you know, they're in a kind of a loggerhead that they couldn't get votes, then that is another tool that they can go to is for the courts to say, Mr. President, I'm sorry, you can't do that. That is outside the jurisdiction of your proper authority under the Constitution, and therefore it's unconstitutional for you to do that. And that's fine, and they could do that way. He's like, they're also going in after the president in court over on Obamacare issues as well. Okay, Chuck, Obamacare, health care. Who's got the responsibility of the Constitution for health care?
The individual.
Exactly, or the states, because it is silent in the Constitution. There is no enumerated power in the United States Constitution for the Congress, the executive, or the judiciary to have any control over matters relating to individual health care.
Yep, and people will say, well, where do you get that from?
The Constitution itself.
Where do you take it from, exactly?
But they're going after the president in court on Obamacare. Well, yeah. That means that they've already ceded the ground that there is no authority for Obamacare to start with. It's illegitimate. I know the courts ruled. John Roberts said it was constitutional if it's a tax. Yeah, okay. That's all fine and well and good, but then that means it's still Congress's role to stop it. And stopping it does not mean repeal and replace. Stopping it means repeal and defund.
Right. By the way,
because that is a way you nullify a law is by taking away its fiscal lifeblood.
Yeah, exactly. You just no money for this agency.
Yep. Well, let's look at some of the other things here. He's like, we're using the power of the purse with riders on a whole host of things. Pro-life riders. Is that is it legitimate for the federal Congress to weigh in on life issues, Chuck?
Only insofar as it is the duty of any government to protect life, not to decide when it begins and when it ends.
Exactly, or what type of life gets protected, whether it's 24 weeks in the womb, 20 weeks in the womb, pain capable in the womb, fetal abnormalities in the womb. How about just in the womb in general? See, there's their problem. They've started parsing and slicing pro-life down to the point where they've actually acted unconstitutionally there as well, because in passing these partial laws, what they've said are certain citizens of the United States have full rights and certain other citizens of the United States do not.
Yeah, exactly. And Barry, you can see that. It comes out in the headlines. Written on articles written by the left. And if you recall, in Ohio, and people may not know this, there was a move to require people who had aborted babies to give them a decent burial or cremation.
Right.
And one of the headlines I saw actually said something like, now get this one, male legislators in Ohio trying to force women to...
with their babies.
Treat fetuses like actual people.
Yeah. Well, Chuck, and I want to go into this next week on our program because those bills are in the Ohio legislature, and I'm actually working on those bills because the way they were introduced opened up a number of loopholes, and this is not against the sponsors who brought these bills forward. But we're working to try to close a lot of loopholes that have been existing in Ohio law since 1974, when we started basically being conciliatory to the pro-death movement after Roe v. Wade. And it's time we change those things. And it's a fight, but I want to update people next week on that. But here we are at the federal level in Congress. And yes, they should be protecting and defending all life, not just partial protections or not just, well... You know, our pro-life positions is we'll give less money to Planned Parenthood to kill unborn babies. You know, how about give them no money at all and prosecute them for their using tax dollars to do something that is, by federal law, illegal? So that really is where we need to be at, and Paul Ryan is not there, you know. And he's talking about riders on the EPA. Well, Chuck, yes, the EPA is a cabinet office of the executive, But is it a cabinet office of the executive that is constitutionally legitimate?
Well, since it was created by fiat by the executive department, a lot of people don't know this. The EPA was created out of thin air, not by an act of Congress, but by an executive order. And who was the president who wrote it?
Richard M. Nixon.
Richard Nixon. This is, and it was essentially that was a vote suck up.
And absolutely.
And Nixon also, I hate to say it this way, but Nixon also saw a way to use the environmental movement to consolidate federal power. So there was some of that involved as well. You know, when I was going before with you, I asked you the question about certain things being left to the individuals or to the states. I raised the question. You probably didn't hear me because we're on Skype today. If it sounds a little funny, I asked the question. Where did that come from in the Constitution? And the answer is the 10th Amendment.
That's right.
The 10th Amendment is absolutely, it's not implicit, it's explicit.
Right.
Any power.
Well, here's another one, Chuck, because one of the things, because of this last week, or just a couple of days ago, or yesterday, excuse me, Obama came forward with his executive order on guns, and we talked a little bit about it earlier. Well, what should Congress do about that, Charles? I mean, when it gets right down to it, has the president exceeded his authority, or should the Justice Department and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, the ATF, and others be more empowered in order to protect us from gun violence, as we hear in the media?
Well, first of all, what they should do is impeach him.
Yeah, absolutely.
Barring that, what they should do is basically cut off all funding for alcohol, tobacco, and firearms if they attempt to enforce this non-law.
Right, and the Justice Department being on its own as well.
Exactly.
But let's go back to the tool. Every tool at his disposal. Well, here, folks, is the tool at their disposal. It's the Second Amendment to the United States Constitution, which says, and I quote, "A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." Now, Chuck, you know, I have to basically issue a public apology to all of our classes in the past and to people on this program, because historically I've taught that the first 10 amendments to the constitutions were restrictions upon Congress. That's only partially true. If you read the First Amendment, it says that Congress shall make no law doing those five things in the First Amendment. The Second Amendment, however, doesn't have, that isn't a general codicil that carries through all 10 amendments. It says in the Second Amendment, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It didn't just say by Congress. That means by any branch of the federal government, the judiciary and the executive included. And so for Obama to issue an order regulating the right of the people to keep and bear arms, or to restrict the right of people to keep and bear arms, they are in violation of the Second Amendment.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely are in violation.
I just want to clarify that, because, yes, Congress is part of the full federal government, and so all 10 amendments to the Bill of Rights and the first part of the Bill of Rights do apply specifically to Congress, but they also apply specifically to other areas, like, you know, the Fourth Amendment, the Seventh Amendment. Those all apply to the courts, to the judiciary as well.
Right.
But the Second Amendment is one of the few amendments that you specifically understand that it applies to all three branches.
Right.
Just the way it's worded. Article 3, about soldiers during times of peace, that's the executive branch. You know that from understanding the Constitution. The Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment all talk about judicial actions,
yeah,
court proceedings, criminal proceedings, capital crimes, things of that nature. We know that that is specifically geared toward limiting the courts. The Second Amendment is the only amendment in the 10 that we know, other than the 10th Amendment, that is directed specifically at all three branches co-equally.
Okay, and you know what? Now that we've really gotten going on this discussion, we are out of time.
We're out of time, of course.
Naturally. Well, okay, you've heard what we think. We want to hear what you think. go to www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. If you want to learn more about the U.S. Constitution, please contact us. We're available. We normally don't have a slot open now with a class, but we do have a slot open for a class right now. So please contact us. That's principledpolicy.com, and join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.